is here. Hello, everybody, once again. Yesterday, I promised you that we shall deal today with the so-called final judgments. And you remember that since 2004, and in response to the large number of cases deriving from systemic or structural problems in certain countries, the court has developed so-called final judgment procedure. This consists in identifying in a simple judgment systemic problems underlying a violation of the European Convention on Human Rights and indicating to states in that judgment the remedial measures required to resolve such situations. Well, this procedure, of course, was criticized by many scholars, of course, by official representatives of states, because it was considered in some states as an interference in the sovereignty of state to legiferate, etc. But nevertheless, this final judgment is developed, and in certain cases, as we shall analyze them, the final judgment procedure is not only intended to facilitate effective implementation by responding states of individual and general measures necessary to comply with the court's judgments, but also induces the respondent state to resolve large number of individual cases arising from the same structural problem at domestic level, and thus reinforcing the principle of subsidiarity which underpins the convention system. Well, and concerning Russia, two final judgments were delivered recently. First of all, Bordov number 2 case, and Ananev and others versus Russia. Let's analyze this case. And I propose to follow the structure of judgments as described on this desk. First of all, procedure measures, facts, relevant domestic and international law and practice, the law part of the judgment, application of Articles 41, if necessary, 46, and the operative part. Yes, and we shall follow the same structure as I don't see on your tables the judgment. That's because you can find it, and in the same time you will deal with the technology of the preparation of judgment. Concerning the procedure issues, interesting to indicate that the applicant was not represented by any lawyer or any NGO. He represented himself, and he won twice in court, yes, especially in this complicated case. And very often, the applicants become themselves representatives of other applicants. It was the case of Rebih, the case of Reznikhir, etc. Once they won a case, all the population of a small city comes to them, and they help them to prepare the application. Bordov was the same. Bordov accompanied at least 30 other applications from his comrades from the city of Shakhty of Rostov region. What is the story of our applicant? The story is rather relevant because the applicant was born in 1952 and lives in the Shakhty Rostov region in the south of Russia. In October 1986, he was called by the military authorities to take part in the emergency operation at the Chernobyl site after this nuclear plant disaster. He was engaged in the operations until 11 January 1987, and as a result suffered from extensive exposure to radioactive emissions. Of course, he is entitled to various social benefits in this connection. There is a special law providing these measures. But considering that the competent state authorities failed to pay these benefits in full and in due time, the applicant repeatedly sued them in domestic courts from 1997 onwards. The court granted the applicant's claims, but a number of their judgments remain unenforced for various period of time, from some month to some years. And for him, this so-called Chernobyl pension was the only income for his life. And as you remember, I mentioned that the first judgment delivered against Russia was Bordov number 1 on the 7th May 2002. The European Court found violation of Article 6 of the Convention, Article 1, Protocol 1, right to property. And in a resolution on 2004, the Committee of Ministers concluded that the Russian Federation respected his obligations towards Bordov, paid him all the awards, all the retarded sums, etc., etc. But after that, the local authorities of Rostov region decided that they can continue this practice to retard the payment. Why? It's a kind of, if you want, mafia scheme. They receive money from Moscow, but they put them in private banks with a certain percent of interest. And the retired person can wait some months, some years. And in this, they enrich themselves, and the poor people still wait. That's because Bordov, who won once in Strasbourg, sent us another application in 2004, and the court decided, for the pedagogical reason, that the best case to deliver a pilot judgment. Well, and in the facts part, the court, with the scrutiny, reflected all these facts concerning the applicant and concerning the relevant domestic law. There is a law on enforcement proceedings. Under the section of this law, the enforcement proceedings had to be completed within 2 months of the receipt of the writ of execution by the bailiff. 2 months. You can compare 2 months provided by law and many months, or sometimes several years, in reality. There is another good decision, especially of the Constitutional Court of Russian Federation, that these provisions governing the special execution procedure are not incompatible, are incompatible with the Constitution. There was also the judgments of the Supreme Court, etc. But the story, the real story was that this judgment were not respected by local authorities. And even if we take into account, and the court mentioned it in its judgment, there is even in criminal law, Article 315, which provides for sanctions for persistent failure by any state official or civil servant to comply with a judicial decision that has entered into legal force. But this provision was never applied in practice. Never applied. They exist only in theory. And we knew that the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation prepared a draft law, or so-called Compensation Act, for the failure to comply with the state obligations. But this draft of law was blocked by a very conservative organization. In each country, it's the most conservative organization, called the Ministry of Finance. Ministry of Finance, lack of money to apply your law, etc., etc. And for the Supreme Court of Russian Federation, the judgment of the Russian of the European Court was a kind of help to accelerate the adoption of this law. That's because they were very enthusiastic with this pilot procedure and accepted it with enthusiasm. But also mentioned in this judgment relevant international material, of course, is numerous resolutions of Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, Parliamentary Assembly concerning non-enforcement of judgments in Russia, in Ukraine, in Italy, in Moldova, and some other countries, etc., etc. We even cited the United Nations preliminary observations following to visit to Russia, rapporteur for independence of judges and lawyers. Well, and the main part of the judgment, of course, is the law part. Is the law part. The law part starts, of course, by the mention of the alleged violation of norms of the European Convention as presented by the applicant. And we are obliged to reproduce the position of the government, the position of the applicant, and the position of the court as the arbiter. Of course, the government position is very simple. It can be reduced in some lines. I can cite it. Paragraph 15 of the judgment. The government lastly referred to the complexity of the enforcement proceedings in this case, given that several judgments were involved. They also emphasized objective circumstances, such as the complexity of the federal multi-level budgetary system and legislative changes which had led to delays in enforcement for which the government were not responsible. It's a standard position of the responsible governments of the European Convention. Yes, there are objective difficulties. That's the end of the story. For the applicant view, the state authorities should also have displayed diligence in this respect, but had failed to take the necessary actions. You understand that these positions are quite natural. And concerning the court's assessment, firstly, the court begins by the general considerations, a kind of review of his positions in previous cases and how the case law was developed. It's very instructive, especially for lawyers and for students who are writing their thesis, because it's a material you can include in your work, and it's rich of information. All the case law of the court concerning these problems. And in this part, you see not only the quotations of Russian judgment, but other judgments, of Hornsby versus Greece, Domingueso versus Portugal, Friedlander versus France, etc., etc. Well, and the most interesting part is the application of these principles to the present case. Yes, and in the court's assessments. And it's a very interesting part of the judgment. I cannot cite many things because for us the main problem is the conclusion of the court that there was no effective remedy against this failure to comply with the state's obligation to be diligent, and thus the court concluded, first of all, to the violation of Article 13 of the Convention, effective remedy, and then to Article 6, of course, Article 1, Protocol 1.
Sorry, did I understand correctly that in this case the court, on its own motion, took up the Article 13? It was not argued by the parties.
No, it was argued by the applicant. By the applicant, yes, yes. We very rarely we invoked articles of the Convention ex officio, the proprio motu. We follow the applicant's reasoning and we reply to the applicant's reasoning.
But you can, actually. You can, because you are not
biased. We can in exceptional cases, yes. We can. Well, in its conclusion on this issue, in the paragraph 117, the court concludes that there was no effective domestic remedy, either preventive or compensatory, that allows for adequate and sufficient redress in the event of the violation of the Convention on account of prolonged non-enforcement of judicial decisions delivered against the state or its entities. There is accordingly a violation of Article 13 of the Convention. Well, and thus the court goes to the key problem. The existence of the structural problem and the necessity to apply the parallel judgment procedure. And it's very interesting that the court noted that the present case can be distinguished in some respect from certain previous pilot cases, as Grinovsky, Kutnashovska, for example. You can find in the paragraph 129, in fact, persons in the same position as the applicant do not necessarily belong to an identifiable class of citizens. Notwithstanding these differences, continue the court considers it appropriate to apply the public judgment procedure in this case, given notably the recurrent and persistent nature of the underlying problems. In Kutnashovska, it was the number of applicants. In this case, the main problem is the repetitive situation during a long period of time. That's because the court decided to use this pilot judgment procedure. And the most important part is, of course, application of Article 46 of the Convention, the obligation of states to execute the judgments of the European Court. It's even more important than the Article 41, awards and compensation for the violation. Of course, Bordov received, as an individual, all the awards concerning the violation of his rights, but the court also dealt with this systemic problem and concluded, paragraph 141, that the respondent state must introduce a remedy which secures genuinely effective redress for the violation of the convention on account of the state's authority's prolonged failure to comply with judicial decisions delivered against the state and its entities. Such a remedy must conform to the convention principle as laid down notably in the present judgment and be available within 6 months from the date on which the present judgment becomes final. The judgment became final some months after. Why? Because the government used his right to contest the judgment and to ask the referral to the Grand Chamber. But the court was rather diligent, and we did everything that the judgment becomes final on the 4th of May of the same year. 4th of May of the same year. And from this date, the state was obliged during 6 months to adopt a new law. After 2-3 months, the government asked to promise that it will be done, but asked 6 months of prolongation to the Committee of Ministers. And this prolongation was afforded, and the Russian President Medvedev, day by day, the 4th May 2010, signed this new law providing the compensation for delay of the execution of judgments and compensation for the delay of procedure for monetary payments of the state. Yes, and we see that in this case, the reaction was rather rapid and rather effective from the state authorities, because it was in air, this remedy, and I explained to you that the Supreme Court prepared this draft law. He was amended, of course, by the Ministry of Finance, reducing some norms who was perhaps too radical, but nevertheless this law entered into force the following day of the signature by the President, and it was decided that this becomes an effective remedy. But in the judgments concerning Bordov 2 case, the court decided to frozen all the applications who will come after the delivery of the judgment, because after the delivery of the judgment, a new remedy can appear, and the rule of exhaustion will be different. But for the applications lodged before the delivery of the judgment, the position of the court was quite different. The court decided to follow a different course of action in respect of the application lodged before the delivery of the judgment. In the court's view, it would be unfair if the applicants in such cases, who have allegedly been suffering for years of continued violations of their right to a court and sought relief in this court, were compelled yet again to resubmit their grievances with the domestic authorities, be it on the grounds of the new remedy or otherwise. That's because we propose to the government to conclude friendly agreements or to deliver a so-called unilateral declaration in which they recognize the violation and express their wish to pay the award equivalent to the awards paid by the European Court. As it was in the Pinto Law procedure in Italy some years before.
Yeah. Could you please clarify what is the procedure of such agreement? For example, if it was a final decision of Russian court, for example, High Court, after then it goes to the European Court of Human Rights, how governments can make these agreements and pay this money?
It's very simple, because they have a list of the applications before the European Court with addresses, etc. This list was communicated to the authorities. And on the domestic level, the local authorities received an instruction to conclude friendly agreements, recognizing the violation and paying some sum of money. Yes, and if the applicant is not in agreement, because the state proposes to him 6,000 euros, as the European Court does, the applicant wants to receive 6 million euros for the rest of his life. Yes. In this case, we accept the unilateral declaration for the good reason from the state, declaring the recognition of the violation and his ability to pay the sum indicated by the European Court. That's the mechanism, rather simple mechanism. Yes. And as a result of this judgment, I have some statistics to deliver to you. First of all, some applicants, when they knew the existence of the new law, they proposed themselves to conclude friendly agreement to the authorities in 27 cases, but mostly in 834 cases. We accepted the unilateral declaration made before the court by the Russian authorities. And in total, more than 1,000 agreements were concluded or we accepted the unilateral declarations. And what's more interesting in this case, the state concluded 50 friendly agreements on non-pecuniary obligations on the state, and more than 20 friendly agreements in criminal cases concerning the procedure of concerning the criminal procedure only in 2011. But of course, these statistics are different for the whole period after the adoption of this law. Of course, this is not a complete happy end of the story, because some months after the entrance into force of the German Board of Two, the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation and the Arbitration Supreme Court of Russia adopted a common resolution explaining to the courts, to their courts, that this judgment and this law concern only the pecuniary obligations, monetary obligations for the state, monetary, not so-called other material obligations, as flats for invalids, for military persons, etc. And If the number of the application concerning non-enforcement of judgment concerning monetary obligation decrease from 40% to 7%, the number of applications concerning other obligations that increased, and we have now more than 400 applications from militaries, from invalids who complained before the court that the state did not respect its obligation to give them apartments or vehicles for invalids and something in this agenda, in this matter. And we are preparing another pilot judgment. We prevented the Russian authorities from engaging another pilot judgment concerning this kind, this category of applications. And they might, they have some months to react to our communication, and we should see the end of the story. The example of Gordov 2 was followed by the court in cases concerning other countries, and the court adopted the case Ivanov versus Ukraine in 15 October 2009, and Olaru versus Moldova in 28 July 2009. If you want, I can write you. Ivanov, it's very simple, because it's a very Ukrainian name, yes. Ukraine, Olaru. Moldova. The same structure, the same reasoning, the same article 46 issue, and even the lawyers, they asked the Russian lawyers to help them don't draft this judgment because the situation are comparable. Well, of course, the reaction was rather positive to this judgment. Even some scholars, like my friend Philip Litch, was rather a skeptic, brilliant, but rather superficial in his analysis. Can the European Court pilot judgment procedure help resolve systemic human rights violations? Bordov and the failure to implement domestic court decision in Russia. In Human Rights Law Review, number 10, 2010. Well, in any case, we can say that when there is a political will from the respondent state, even the pilot judgment can be enforced rather easily if there is really a political will, if the legislator reacts rather speedily. It's more difficult to execute these judgments in other cases that need more complex remedies, and this is the Ananis case, the other case concerning overpopulation of detention prisons in Russia. What is interesting in this case, Ananiev case, first of all, we used many official statistics provided by the Russian authorities and by the applicants. Concerning, for example, the overpopulation of detentions on remand of the Astrakhan region, we cited the report of the Ombudsman of the Astrakhan region, for example. And the statistics provided by the Ombudsman of the Astrakhan region are rather scandalous. I can say, and rather interesting. For example, detention on remand. IZ, изолятор in Russian, istotina pizimvich, very different. Maximum capacity, 642 places. Real number of detainees. In 2004, 2005, 2006, no comments. Another detention facility in the same region. The capacity 267 inmates. In reality, no comments at all, and even Russian authorities didn't comment this text because it's a reality. Well, and of course, when the court analyzes the measures adopted on the national level, we concluded that one of the main problems of the old population of the Russian detained prisoners is the placement in custody and trial outcomes. I mentioned you yesterday that one of the systemic problems is the very huge use of detention on remand by Russian tribunals. We use also the official statistics provided by the Judicial Department of the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation. Application for detention order granted. 2007. 90%. For the rest of the years, 90.1, 90.1, 90. Yes. Application for an extension order. Granted. Even more. 20 automatically tribunals granted demands the applications of prosecutors, of investigative bodies to proceed to the detention of the applicant. That's because these prisons are overpopulated. Well, and of course we analyzed also the famous program, federal program for development of the penitentiary, because the Russian government approved a federal expeditionary program under the title Development of the Criminal Justice and Penitentiary System in Russia, and the total amount of the financing is very impressive. It's very impressive. The federal government awarded ₹54 billion for this program. That means in euros, €1.35 billion for 10 years. Of course, some prisons were constructed, renovated, etc. But even the Minister of Justice, when it replied to our communication, had aesthetic pleasure to indicate that each year the sums are reduced by 30% or 40%. For the sum provided annually for this marriage. They send us a message, please cite it in your journal. And we did, because it was the information provided by an official body. Yes, and of course, you understand that these facts led us directly to the conclusion that we are dealing with a really systemic problem, and this systemic problem, this systemic problem is not only contrary to the norms of the European Convention concerning human and degrading treatment, but also to the European standards concerning prisoners. There is a so-called European Prisons Rules adopted in 2006 by the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, and these rules are not respected by many countries. It concerns France, Italy, Poland, Russia, Ukraine, and some other countries. And that's because, in our public judgment, we decided to enlarge the view of the court and not only concentrate on the Russian problems. And you can read a very interesting part of this judgment from the paragraph 61 to 65. When we give the public judgment proceedings concerning the overcrowded problem in Poland, because before the adoption of the judgment concerning Ananiev, the court adopted two public judgments in the cases Orzechowski versus Poland and Norbert Sikorski versus Poland in 22 October 2009, in which it found under Article 46 of the Convention that for many years the overcrowding in Polish remand centers had revealed a structural problem consisting as a practice that was incompatible with the Convention. We have our case law, as the cases Ivanov and Polago has for their case law, the Bordov II judgment. We have the Orzechowski and Sikorski judgments in this case as the case law of reference. And in October 2009, the Polish Parliament enacted a law amending the Code of Execution of Criminal Sentences, which entered into force on December of the same year. It introduced a number of new rules governing temporary placement of detainees in cells below the statutory norm of 3 square meters per inmate. 3 square meters. European standards are 7 square meters. Russian standards are 4 square meters. In Poland, it's 3 square meters per inmate. Perhaps it was considered to be sufficient. Of course, I can remember the famous phrase of the late Leon Tolstoy, who in the end of his life told that a man definitely needs only for 2 square meters for his group. Yes, here it's very generous. Poland about 3 square meters, Russia 4 square meters. Well, perhaps it's rather generous. But the statistics are like they are. And with this case law as reference, the European Court decided to apply also the same principle that was used in the Bordov II case and to provide some general measures. But you understand that one thing is to adopt a new law for non-payment of rewards. It's more simple than to modify the system all of some centuries. It needs not only legislative measures, but also financial investments, also administrative measures, etc. That's because the part concerning Article 46 is rather huge and rather general. It occupies 20 pages, 60 paragraphs. I participated in the drafting, and I can confess to you we did it especially to show to the governments what can be different solutions of the problem from the material point of view, legislative point of view, administrative point of view, etc., 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 without indicating some specific measures. And we note that the object of the valid German procedure is to facilitate the speediest and most effective resolution of a dysfunction affecting the protection of the convention rights in question in the national legal order. And in this judgment, I would like to draw your attention on the following issues. The court declared, you will be perhaps rather sceptic about this conclusion. It's not for the court's task to specify what would be the most appropriate way to set up the necessary remedies. In Bordeaux, we indicated directly adoption of new law. Here, you, in the of the dimension of the problem, we concluded more prudently. It's not our task to specify, but we obliged the Russian government to provide to the Committee of Ministers during 6 months after entering into force of the judgment, a program of remedies concerning the execution of the judgment. Month by month, year by year, and to facilitate the task of the committees. I had a sadic pleasure, to introduce the following phrase to the judgment. The Committee of Ministers is best equipped for that kind of task. Because that reimbursed to the court this task. But the court replied that they are better equipped for this kind of task. they must supervise the execution of the judgment. And in view of the foregoing, the court concludes, I cite the paragraph 234. The court concludes that the Russian government must produce, in cooperation with the Committee of Ministers, within 6 months from the date on which this judgment becomes final, a binding time frame in which to make available preventive and compensatory remedies in respect of alleged violations of Article 3 of the Convention on account of inhuman and degrading conditions of detention. What about the applications of this category before the court? You remember that in Bordeaux we froze a great number of applications. In this case, it was decided that it would be not appropriate because the situation is more complicated, and that's because the court decided that the better way to redress could be ad hoc solutions such as friendly settlements with the applicants or unilateral remedial offers in line with the convention requirements. Yes, we send a message to the authority that they must immediately begin the friendly settlement negotiation with all the applicants who complain the conditions of the detention remand. Number of 600 perhaps and more. And the government started to negotiate with the applicants. You see that the reaction of the court to this problem is, of course, more prudent, but rather concrete to be enforceable. And as the operative part, I can cite the following points. Firstly, of course, the state must produce in cooperation with the Committee of Ministers a binding time frame, and also that the respondent state must grant redress to all victims of inhuman or degrading conditions of detention in Russian remand prisons, CISO, who lodged their application with the court before the delivery of this judgment, within 12 months from the date on which this judgment becomes final, or from the date on which the applications will have been communicated to the government, whichever comes later. You see that the court was rather precise in this, rather concrete in this case. Of course, concerning the individual awards, the court awarded to Anani 2,000 euros in respect of non-pecuniary damage, and to the other applicant who spent much more time in detention, 13,000 euros of non-pecuniary damage. And of course, costs and expenses. You see that, comparing these two parallel judgments, you see that it's very difficult task for the court to have a realistic approach to each problem. That's because it's a very difficult exercise for the court to respect the subsidiarity principle and to award to a state a margin for appreciation when it concerns the remedies on the national level for the enforcement of the above mentioned judgments. Yes, but I see that even if in the court we criticize, we are very often criticized this parallel judgment procedure because it's a very hard task for the court, replacing the bureaucrats of the Council of Ministers or the Council of Committee of Ministers, Council of Europe. But nevertheless, after 8 years of the practice of this procedure, the court delivered more than 25 or 26 judgment, pilot judgment concerning dozens of countries, and this procedure can be appreciated as a one of the intentions of the court to resolve systemic problems in the contracting states. Of course, the reaction of some governments are different. For example, in Olaru case, the Moldovan government replied that they don't have for this year sufficiently sums in their budget to conclude a friendly agreement as Russia has. And they asked the prolongation for 1 year to the Council of Ministers. It's their difficulties, of course. I don't know the result of their demarche. But nevertheless, it proves that the states try to respond to their international obligations provided by the convention. And you know that now, after the entrance into force of the Protocol 14, there are two new disposed norms in the Article 46 of the Convention that provide that if the state consistently does not execute the judgment of the European Court, the Committee of Ministers can ask the court to conclude that the state failed to execute its obligations, general obligations under the Convention, and the problem will be to exclude or to suspend the participation of the national state in the system of the convention. It was the case of Italy with the delay of civil procedures. One day, in Italy, they urgently adopted the famous Pinto law. Pinto was a senator who proposed this law in 2001, and now the Cassational Court of Italy had a hard task to decide all the cases concerning the delay of procedure and to award effective award. But there are some difficulties in the implementation of this law, but nevertheless, it's one of the examples in showing us that the states are under a rather severe control of not only the Committee of Ministers, but also of the Parliament Assembly of the Council of Europe, and this initiative of the court to indicate to the states some issues is perhaps a new trend in the activities of the court, because it's not provided by any article of the convention, only by the resolution of the Committee of Ministers of 2004, but nevertheless everybody accepts its non-written norm. And we continue on this way. Yes, that's what I wanted to say to you. We have some minutes to questions if you want.
one question. Could you please answer whether the court is entitled to recommend so-called general measures or measures of general corruption in the decisions which are issued not in procedure of final judgment, but in other procedures, in simple procedure? For example, in the case of Konstantin Markin versus Russia, it was very serious because it was not a final judgment, but it was a very precise recommendation that the norm must be cancelled by the Russian
government. We applied it for a long time, this methodology, when we are dealing with so-called quality of law as a source of violation. It's not only in Martin case. Just before Martin case, in the case Anatoly Bykov versus Russia in Grand Chamber case, we indicated that the law of operative search contains many norms which can lead to the abuse of authority of investigating bodies. And everybody was harmed because we didn't touch neither the Supreme Court, neither the Constitutional Court. We indicated also that this violation of Article 8 provides for the quality of law, which norms are too general. In the Martin case, we said the same thing, that the law on the status of military is rather discriminatory for the male servicemen, yes, than the females. You see, the direction was different, quite different. But this indication of general measures, for example, I mentioned yesterday the case L versus Lithuania. Well, the court concluded that the violation of the transsexual applicant had a source of the quality of law regulating these issues in Lithuania. And we also proposed to Lithuania to change the law on 3 months. Yes, it was not a final judgment, yes. But when we are dealing with the quality of law issue, yes, we can do it without introducing a final judgment. In Stukaturov case versus Russia, and Kamachov, we did the same. When it was a placement to the psychiatric hospital, we also indicated that this violation what has as a source some norms who were not well interpreted by the authorities.
It's very important because this case now, after the Shukatov case, is in the Constitutional
Court. I know that the Supreme Court reacted, yes.
And I think the decision of the Constitutional Court will be different from the first one, just because of your decision.
Yes. That's because we use this methodology indicating general measures, but please don't think that all this judgment has the impact of private judgments. No, the private judgment is based on structural and systemic problems, repetitive cases. And before adopting the Vordov case, we calculated, we issued more than 200 judgments concerning that same situation. In Ananiev case, in the annex, what's also interesting, we mentioned list of 90 judgments in which we concluded the same violation, with indication of the city, Kalashnikov, Magadan, CISO 47, etc., Maizid, Kaliningrad, Novosel, Novosibirsk, Frolov, St. Petersburg, etc., etc. And there is a list of our judgments, and we can look at it's a repetitive situation. Don't mix it with that. If you want, I can give you a Russian version of this judgment and a well translated, because the translations are not always good. And you can find this list of judgments. Well, other questions?
How technical is decided that yes, now we will have this public judgment? Is it decided by the panel, or is it somehow procedurally regulated inside the court?
No, I must develop here a theory of complot. Because there is a kind of complot between judge rapporteur, president of the section, and the lawyer dealing with the case. For example, if you read Ananiev, the procedure part, there is paragraph 5. On 14th May 2009, the court decided to communicate the applicant's complaint to the government, raising specific additional questions about the structural nature of the underlying problems. Yet, we prevent the state. We send the message. When we send them our questions, is this problem provides from the structural problem, systemic problem? We send a message to the government, we shall adopt a final judgment. And we need a more developed reply from the government. And of course, these cases for us are priority cases, and we deal with them more speedily than with ordinary cases. Yes, but who decides? Of course, a national judge with a judge rapporteur, if he, the national judge is not rapporteur in this case, the lawyer and the chamber decides to communicate as a pilot judge, future pilot judge in the case. Yes.
I have one question about Russian criminal courts. It's a bit off the current topic, but I noticed that both in the Hankovsky case and the current Tomko Land case, the defendants are situated in a cage at the time of the trial. Can you tell me why that is, even in cases of non-violent crimes? And has any court analyzed whether this goes against presumption of innocence or unbiased trial?
Everybody paid attention to Khodorkovsky case. But the first time we did it in Ogorodnikov case, much before the Khodorkovsky case, we concluded that the placement of the applicant, of the accused person, to the cage is a human degrading treatment. And in many courts, in Moscow, in Perm, in other cities, they modified now the furniture, and that now they are in the transparent cabin. But many of them thought that it even worse, because when you are in cage, you can respire easily, you can communicate with your lawyer. When you're under the glasses, it's more difficult and less comfortable. But now Russia follows the European standards. Everything is relative in life. Yes, of course, when we see it, and in Norway, Breivik is just seated comfortably on the chair, etc., with his lawyer, it's another tradition. Yes, but in many countries, they maintain the system. Of course, in this, in our judgments, in several times we underline this issue that when we deal with the conditions in trial hall, we take into account also this problem. But it's not only this problem. For us, if you you can read for the Moiseev case, the spy Moiseev case. When we concluded to violation of Article 3 because of the conditional transportation from the prison to the court. Because especially in Moscow, when even you are in taxi or under a car, you spend 3-4 hours to go from one side to Moscow to another side, yes? Because of the traffic. You can imagine there are 12 or 20 persons in a small car, etc. It's in human conditions, yes? Also, when they are waiting to be invited to the courtroom, they are waiting in small cabins, also not well equipped in many courts. That's because it's not only the problem of the cage. Yes, I understand, but other elements too in the procedure. Of course, we had a dozen of judgment concerning this issue. It's also is under the control of the court, of course. But not only in Russia, but for me especially in Russia, because I'm a national judge. Some more questions? Nothing for the moment? Yes. Thank you for your attention. We have finished just in time, yes. David.